man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Welcome to another episode of Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Iffy Whitey Way, and in the booth with me are my friends. So let me introduce you to them. All right, first up, we have Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good?
Oh, gosh. You know, Iffy, I know this is the least cool answer ever and probably one that half the audience already knows I'm going to say, but I don't care. It's Christmas in July on the Hallmark Channel, and I feel less guilt than ever about, like, dumb escapism, because that's just where we are as a civilization. We're halfway through this fakakta year, and it just can't be over soon enough. So any palliative I can take in the meantime is just going to get me through.
Yeah, I know. It's just, I can use a Christmas to July, if only to pretend that we're further along in the year than we actually are.
By the way, I clocked you saying palliative, and it's right up there with when you work in, like, efficacy. I love it. I mean, the vocab. Oh, it really makes me so happy.
Enrich your word power with Who Shot Ya?
Oh, and speaking of vocab, we have the vocabulous Drea Clark. What's good?
What's good with me is actually a sort of Who Shot Ya reflective element, which is that last week, one of the games we played was we each picked a standalone movie that could be that we would like to have seen spun into a numerous a variety of sequels and a musical and a TV series. And as you guys know, I picked American Psycho, and the amount of Who Shot Ya listeners that reached out to me to let me know that there was in fact an American Psycho musical already with music by Duncan Sheik, like, warmed my heart. I'm a little embarrassed I didn't know that. It seems like the thing I would like to know. I'm a real know-it-all. And so that was upsetting, but the absolute solidification of my trust in our listeners of being musical theater fans feels real good.
So I think I knew it, and it flew out of my head at some point.
That's what I mean, Alonzo. I didn't want to say. Talk about know-it-alls. Actually know it all.
I'm letting down so many sides here.
And anyway, musical theater people in our midst. That's what's good with me.
We also have another good person in our midst, and that's film critic and host of Malton on the Movies, Leonard Malton. What's good?
Such an exciting good person.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very sweet of you. Thank you. What's good? Well, what's good is that my wife and I have now surrendered to HGTV.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Hometown?
Stress-free television. It's, you know, it soothes the nerves and helps pass the time. Mm. So at one time I would have called it a guilty pleasure, but now I have no guilt.
Yeah.
Yes. It is all simply pleasure. A pleasure.
Ben and Arian Napier are national heroes at this point.
They are.
I love them. I love Hometown so much. Iffy, if it's not HGTV, what's good with you?
Well, if it's not HGTV, you know it's QVC, because my ice cream maker attachment for my KitchenAid stand mixer came yesterday. It is sitting in the freezer right now, and me and Naomi are going to have a project to make ice cream. I'm afraid of saying it too loud, because that means she's going to rush into the living room and ask me about it. But yeah,
well,
she's...
What flavor are you planning?
I don't know. I think I want to go and take her to the store and let her kind of decide the flavors that she wants to do, with, you know, overseeing it and vetoing ones that I don't like.
I asked because last night, unbeknownst to me, my daughter brought home from the supermarket a something I'd read about in People magazine about a month ago, Ben and Jerry's new Chip Happens flavor, which is a chocolate ice cream base filled with chocolate chips and potato chips.
Oh,
okay.
I'm in.
Oh, see? Yeah. No one's making fun of that now.
Ours is going to be some cacophony of gummy bears and marshmallows and some chocolate that she likes.
Gum and nuts.
And nuts. It's funny because she's, you know, she's four, so she's at that age where, you know, colors are specific flavors, because, like, I gave her half of a red velvet donut, and she was like, strawberry. I'm like, no, that's red velvet. And I was like, oh, I'll have to explain to you what red velvet is. But I didn't.
You can get her the blue Captain Crunch syrup they just put out.
Oh,
now that Aunt Jemima's been retired, they're still putting out Captain Crunch syrup, and it's the same flavor, but it's blue, and it's designed to go with the pancake mix that has the crunch berries in it.
Of course,
I have not eaten any of this, and I don't know that I plan to, but it's in there. It's in the world.
Just know I will, because I have tasted both the Twinkie cereal, the Honey Bun cereal, any Hostess cereal, the donut cereal, all the cereals that people post and go, oh, America is screwed if we're eating that. I'm eating it because I got to know what it tastes like. I need to know. And the
donuts is really good.
Yeah, the donuts are great. The Honey Bun are great. Twinkies are very, like, the first bowl was okay, and then after that it just kind of, because it has that, like, filmy, like, aftertaste where you, like, have that, like, oh yeah, I tasted something processed.
The taste of regret.
Yeah.
many years ago, something like 35 years ago, when my wife and I first moved here from New York City, I had become fond of a new-ish Kellogg's cereal called Raisins, Rice, and Rye. So yeah. Alice went shopping. I said, be sure to buy me some boxes of that cereal that I like. And she found, like, one box, and the supermarket said, that's the last one we've got. So the first step was to write a letter. I'm a big letter writer. To write a letter to Kellogg's in Battle Creek, Michigan, and express my dismay at what seemed to be the phasing out of this wonderful cereal. And I got a very nice note from their public relations department. And, of course, I wrote it on Entertainment Tonight letterhead, you know.
that's the hidden knife, but the knife is there.
Yeah, well, exactly. If you've got it, flaunt it. So they wrote back and they said, no, we're still producing it. It hasn't been as successful as we'd hoped, but we're still producing the cereal. And they gave me a printout of stores near me that supposedly stocked it, which was a lie because most of them we'd been to already. So, they sent me two boxes for free. They said, we're not allowed to sell direct to customers. We'll be happy to have you enjoy these two sample boxes.
Ideally on camera.
Then I said, wait a minute. There's this store that we've been going to a little bit called Gelson's. And we were newbies here in Southern California, and Gelson's prides itself on being a service-oriented store. So I said, Alice, go to the manager and see if he'll special order a case of cereal. So she did, and the man said, yeah, I'll check in with me by next Monday. And we got a call, yes, your cereal's ready. Now, I didn't know how many boxes would be in a case. So I said to Alice, when you get there, order a second case. And she did, and the man said, this is the last case. So there were 10 boxes in that case, and I was the last person in these United States to consume Kellogg's Raisin Rice and Rye cereal.
Oh,
I was hoping you were going to get like 1,000 boxes in that case. And the end of the story was going to be you're still consuming.
That would make a much better story.
Oh, well. On today's special show, in celebration of the 30th anniversary of the release of this film, we're spending all episodes talking about Gremlins 2, The New Batch. And, of course, we're taking a call from the Who Shot line, and we'll have some staff picks. So, since one of the stars of Gremlins 2, The New Batch, is in our presence, let's get right to the movie discussion. Treya, would you mind providing a synopsis for us?
I would be honored. Okay, so I'm going to go some from the written one because they, you know, they wrote it. The magical collectible store that Gizmo calls home has just been destroyed, and the tiny monster finds his way into a newly erected skyscraper built by Daniel Clamp, and so it is, of course, Clamp Tower. I don't know if you catch any parallels there. Old Clamp. Billy Peltzer, returning from the first film, is now engaged to Kate, the Phoebe Cates character, and obviously they have previously dealt with the gremlins running amok and discover that out of nowhere, Gizmo from their past is in this building and has somehow, of course, once again sprouted an impish legion of reptilian pals who are now inhabiting the downtown building. The couple tries to stop the creatures from escaping into New York City, but you guys, this new batch of beasts might be uncontrollable. Dun, dun, dun!
Now, Dre, I believe you were having to catch up, not just on this film, but you'd never seen the first Gremlins either?
Right. I watched the first Gremlins. I made a point to watch it a week ago so that I hopefully wouldn't be conflating the two of them. And then once I saw this one, I was like, well, that was not going to be a problem. I was not going to mix those two up.
So a thing I didn't know was that, of course, Leonard has this extraordinary cameo in Gremlins 2 as himself being attacked by Gremlins for his review of the first movie. I didn't know that you genuinely didn't like the first movie and that that's what you were goofing. I'm like, that... my hat is so further removed to you because I just assumed the joke was, well, of course you like the first one, but to make it work, you had to pretend like you didn't. But you really didn't like number one.
No, that's the backstory about all this. And I'll try to keep this as concise as I can. But I'm a native New Yorker, grew up in the suburbs, mostly in Teaneck, New Jersey. And in South Jersey, closer to Philadelphia, there was a young movie buff of extraordinary intensity and extraordinary knowledge named Joe Dante. And we crossed paths several times, and we never became close friends, but we liked each other. And so time passed, and we both found ourselves out here. He working for Roger Corman's New World Pictures, along with some other friends, mutual friends, like John Davison and Alan Arkush, and the list goes on to include a good many people who made subsequent reputations for themselves. Anyway, Joe was cutting trailers for New World, which means he not only cut trailers for Death Race 2000, but also for Armacord.
Right.
For, you know, because Roger started distributing major European art films.
The story of Adele H. Yeah.
I was like, if you're not familiar, it is a very wide range between those two films.
Yes.
They are not next door neighbors.
Anyway, John Davison went on to produce Airplane very successfully. And, Joe and Alan Arkush co-directed Rock and Roll High School, which was successful too. And then Joe got a big break. He got he came to the attention of Steven Spielberg, and he directed a segment of the ill-fated Twilight Zone movie and did a very good job. And that got him the opportunity to shoot Gremlins. And I had then been hired in the interim to be the movie reviewer on this new national nightly syndicated TV show called Entertainment Tonight, which at that time had an enormous audience. There was nothing like it, nothing remotely like it on the air. It was before the E Channel. It was before any shows of this kind. In fact, two of the shows that became rivals were formed by former producers of Entertainment Tonight. So they created their own competition. Anyway, it's now 1983, and I go to see the movie at a crowded screening at in Westwood. Well, I didn't really know filmmakers, and I didn't pursue friendships with filmmakers. But in this case, I found myself in the very uncomfortable position of having to give a negative review to a movie made by someone I knew. And if this was a newspaper, I would have recused myself and handed it to the alternate reviewer, the second string reviewer. But I was it at Entertainment Tonight. And this was a big, big release. It was a Spielberg-produced movie and had all the earmarks of a summer blockbuster. And I found it too mean-spirited for my taste. I mean, I liked a lot of things about it. And Joe filled it with inside jokes for his film buff pals. They just don't stop. You know, where else are you going to find some reference to Chuck Jones Junior High School? I trust my gut. My gut reaction was it was a little too nasty. So I lost sleep over how to handle this. I didn't really know how to handle this. And I didn't handle it as ideally as I could have. And mea culpa for that. I went on the air and gave an honest review. I felt ultimately that's all I could do, because all you've got as a critic is your credibility. And if you lose or sabotage that, you're dead in the water. So I did the review. It was not a nasty review, but it wasn't a positive review. And it caused something of a rift between Joe and me. And I completely understood that. No one likes to be criticized, including me. And I've been criticized plenty. It's just, you know, whether it's personal or on a higher plane than that, it's just no fun at all. A couple of years go by and I get a phone call from Mike Fennell, who was then Joe's producing partner. And he tells me that they're doing a belated sequel to Gremlins, where the Gremlins are going to invade a TV network and intrude on several shows in progress, and they wanted to have a movie review show and wanted me to be the reviewer, and I would get killed by the Gremlins. And I said, well, I think I owe you that. So thus I found myself on a weekday driving on the main lot at Warner Brothers in Burbank and having a reserved parking space and going to a stage where Joe proceeded to hand me a cassette of the VHS release of the original Gremlins. And what he said was, just use your own words. So I don't like throwing the word unique around, but in what may well be a unique situation, I was directed to give a bad review again to a movie in the sequel to that movie.
3, 2, 1, cue Leonard.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin, and this is the Movie Police. Today we'll start with our video watch. Just re-released on video is the movie Gremlins, though I really can't imagine why. Now, I know some people found this movie fun, but me, I'd rather spend 2 hours having root canal work done. What's fun about a movie full of ugly, slimy, mean-spirited, gloppy little monsters who run amok and attack innocent people? Our moviegoers so desperate for entertainment that this movie crashed and passed for fun. Wait a minute! I'm just kidding! Oh, a 10! It's a 10!
And everyone thought it was, I think we did 2 takes. Everyone thought it was just hilarious. I'm not in a position to judge that, but everybody seemed to love it. And I went to a press event for the home video release of E.T. the Extraterrestrial, where I met Steven Spielberg, and who was executive producer of Gremlins 2, the new batch. And he said, oh, I love that scene you did. In fact, we'd like to use it in the trailer. And yeah, I said, I don't know if I like that idea. I think the idea is to have it appear as a total surprise in the middle of the film. And he saw my point, and we did. They didn't go ahead with that plan, which I'm grateful for, because I think it was meant to be what it was meant to be and where it was supposed to be. So That's how and why that came about. And I wrote Joe a note saying that while he had given me a certain degree of immortality, what really mattered was I was on 3 gum cards of the story of the film. And I've signed many of those for collectors over the years.
Amazing. And,
look, Lucy Van Pelt says, if Beethoven was so great, why isn't he on a bubblegum card? So you clearly got it over Beethoven, Leonard.
So that is my saga.
Did you think it was fully possible that you would dislike the second film as much as you did the first? And you still were like, all right, I'll still do this.
It was up for grabs. I said yes without having seen any of the film or read the script because I thought it was only fair. And so I didn't have great trepidations. As it happens, I did like and do like the sequel better than the original, but I am not in any way objective. I can't pretend to be.
It's like Roger Ebert reviewing Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Yeah.
I was, I went and looked up the card, and there's a Reddit post with one of the cards where it's like a twofer, just for people who haven't seen the card. On the top, it's you and the gremlin surrounding you, and at the bottom, it's the body, you at the bottom of the chair, and the movie police sign, and then it's Gizmo at the bottom saying a definite thumbs down. And the reason I say all this is because the top Reddit post on this is 2 issues with this. Number 1, thumbs down would refer to Siskel and Ebert, not Maltin. And number 2, Doug Benson would be very upset to see this. That is the top Reddit post on this card. I like it. I'm a fan. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about some more Gremlins 2, The New Batch, just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
I started listening to Ono, Ross, and Carrie shortly after I broke my arm, and the doctor had told me I'd never walk again.
I couldn't get my book started.
I was lost, honestly.
I knew it was time to make a change.
There's something about Ono, Ross, and Carrie that you just can't get anywhere else.
They're thought leaders, discoverers, founders.
I'd call them heroes.
Ross and Carrie don't just report on fringe science, spirituality, and claims of the paranormal. They take part themselves.
They show up so you don't have to.
But you might find that you want to.
My arm is better. I can walk again.
I wrote an entire book this weekend. It's terrible, but I did it.
Just go to MaximumFun.org.
Thank you, Ross and Carrie.
Ono, Ross and Carrie is just a podcast. It doesn't do anything. It's just sounds you listen to in your ears. All these people are made up. Goodbye.
Welcome back to Who Shot You? I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe, and in the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Leonard Maltin.
Alonzo Duraldi.
And we're going to keep this Gremlins 2, The New Batch train rolling.
What I think one of the things that is so perfect about Leonard being in this movie, in addition to his, you know, review of the first film, Leonard is also, I think, one of the leading experts on Warner Brothers animation, you know, Tex Avery and Chuck Jones. I used, Of Mice and Magic as a textbook in college. I'm sure a lot of people have. So, because this movie is so sort of grounded in that world, I'm wondering, Leonard, if you could kind of give us just sort of in a nutshell, for people maybe who aren't as familiar with the old Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck cartoons, why that spirit just sort of permeates this movie and how that manifests.
Well, Joe Dante is one of the world's foremost fans of Warner Brothers cartoons. And there are allusions to those cartoons in, I think, every film he makes. I remember bits and Small Soldiers and Explorers and Inner Space. There are always connections, some subtle, some more obvious. And
yeah, I think Looney Tunes Back in Action might have one or two of those as well.
And irreverence is the heartbeat of those cartoons. They were made by a bunch of guys who got no recognition for what they were doing. There was no contemporary magazine or newspaper reviewing or feature story writing, they were virtually ignored except by the audience that watched and enjoyed them. And even they took them for granted. So it was a kind of an us versus them mentality. Those guys working for Warner Brothers, big time movie studio, and you know, nothing sows the seeds of irreverence more than that. And they were all young: Chuck Jones, Bob Clampett, Frank Tashlin, Friz Freleng, Tex Avery, Chuck Jones, of course. They were, you know, they were mischievous. And their main goal was to make themselves laugh. Because these cartoons, which not everybody knows who of a younger generation, weren't meant for television and were not aimed at kids. They were meant to be shown, as accompaniment to a feature film 7 days a week. So that means with adult audiences as well as children's audiences at Saturday matinees. And so they figured if they amused each other on the staff, that was a pretty good arbiter of whether they were going to reach their audience.
Yeah, I did. That's a good point to bring up, because I was watching with Naomi, and I was in the original game was going to be how long was Naomi going to watch this before she got too scared or went away. But she enjoys.
How old is Naomi?
She's 4.
Okay.
So she was enjoying it from start to finish, because at first I was like, oh, PG-13, this might be a little too scary or something, you know. And she called the gremlins dragons, which I kept correcting her that it's a gremlin, not a dragon, and the Mogwai monkeys, which I had to keep correcting. That's a Mogwai, not a monkey, baby. But she, you know, I may be a dad, but I'm still a pedantic nerd. she enjoyed it. She liked all the little, especially the physical humor that's in it. She got it and was on board. And she liked when at the beginning when Gizmo dances, she was all on board for that. And yeah,
the shot of Gizmo dancing is one of the first reasons when I was watching this, I was like, oh, I'm going to have a very different response to this than I did the first one, because it's not just Gizmo dancing, which is a clear technological leap from the other one, because it's a full body. It's obviously been green screen, but he's dancing and Christopher Lee is staring at him. And I would watch a half an hour of just Christopher Lee staring at what is meant to be a Gizmo dancing, because it was magical. He acts the whole time.
It's interesting that you mentioned the PG-13-ness of it, Ify, because this is actually the first Gremlins is one of the movies that made PG-13 happen. Summer of 84 was Gremlins and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, both of which had the sort of Steven Spielberg Amblin seal of approval on them. And then parents were freaking out because they were so violent and intense. And so by the end of that summer, we had PG-13 as a new rating to cover for this kind of movie that wasn't R but was not for kids necessarily.
Oh wow. Well, you know, look, it's Naomi approved, so you know, that's the second.
did she have a favorite, or does anyone have a favorite of these? Gremlins,
you know, mine's is always going to be Sexy Gremlin. She has a name. I mean, I was just blown away by how much effort went into let us know she was sexy in that pan up. I was like, look, she has a nice butt. She has a nice butt. You gotta. And I was like, all right, I'm here with you, Gremlins. I'm on this train with you.
Well, Leonard alludes to all the inside jokes in Gremlins, and then in this movie you have that whole thing where Rhapsody in Blue is playing and everybody's doing the Busby Berkeley with the giant cards that make her face. That's out of Dames.
It was insane. I was gobsmacked. There were so many things in this that were just great. They were the most topical things. Every item of clothing people were wearing. The whole idea of actually this building, which to me is very much has a Trump vibe, you have John Glover playing Daniel Clamp, which even sounds like it, and he's built this building and he's just this obsessive narcissistic real estate developer, go figure. But there was something about watching this movie from 1992 talking about 90. a smart 90. Oh, right. Yeah. Talking about a smart building and all yeah. of the, I was like, oh, that term, that's a term. Like, obviously I can think of, like Ray Bradbury stuff that would have similar references, but it seemed so prescient in weird, weird ways. And mm-hmm. yeah, that sort of blew my mind.
I think my favorite thing about Gremlins 2 is that it is not just a sequel that pivots into a complete different kind of comedy, but it actively mocks the first film. the whole sequence where they're going over the rules and they're asking questions like, well, okay, what if he gets something stuck in his teeth before midnight, but then he swallows the caraway seed after midnight and he's in a plane that's flying over time? So it's like they're calling out the sort of ludicrous elements of the first movie. And for a sequel, that is such a flex to actively make oh, yeah. fun of the cash cow that is being milked again.
It's hilarious when they do that, but then they also give the moment of the gremlins then come in and start attacking those people. So like
yes.
that he's still vindicated, because yes. I wanted both of those things and was given both of those.
Exactly.
Things.
You may mock this, but we're still going to destroy you.
Exactly. Exactly.
There's a great Twitter feed that hasn't activated in a while that's called like the Institute for Gremlins 2 Studies, which is really funny and really smart, and they really kind of look into the whole sort of political perspective here, like the notion that Gizmo is a collaborator because he's always siding with the humans and turning on his own kind. Ooh. You know, which I think would explain why when these other creatures are accidentally, you know, created, the first thing they want to do is destroy Gizmo, even though he is the father to them all. You know, there's a lot of layers here. I mean, this is a movie where you can actually get away with using the word metatextual, I think, and it, you know, it does bear out.
Now there are one or two gags that don't play on home video that were intended specifically for theater going audiences.
True.
And I'm forgetting the details, but Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
Is he an usher in a movie theater?
Paul Bartel is a movie theater manager, and he goes and finds mm-hmm. Hulk Hogan to get the gremlins to leave the projection room because mm-hmm. the film has broken. And then I think the VHS release actually had a whole other version of that. Where
they
gremlins,
did an alternate version just for home video.
Right. And if you get the Blu-ray, you can see both versions. But like the one I saw streaming last night still has the theatrical yeah, gag.
Great.
Of,
I'm so glad that's not lost to the mists of memory.
Yeah, which and in turn that's another inside joke, because that whole segment is a shout out to William Castle's The Tingler, you know, where the yeah. film apparently breaks and then you hear Vincent Price's voice say, you know, ladies and gentlemen, The Tingler is loose in this theater, you know.
Hulk Hogan, much like frozen yogurt, being one of those things that very much established this
moment,
as a 1990
yeah.
film. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I was like, man, this is take me back to before we knew what he was saying and how he was, what his dick looked like. Take me back to that time.
We were all so innocent then. Yeah. And I love that Daniel Clamp combines the worst of Donald Trump, but then also the worst of Ted Turner, because that was that moment where he was going in and mucking about with, you know, obviously he's done a lot of good with the MGM RKO libraries and Warner Brothers. So I all respect due, but you know, he was trying to colorize Citizen Kane, and so this movie does have that great throwaway gag where they say that tonight on Clamp Classic Movies, it's Casablanca, now in color and with a happier ending.
Wait, isn't it It's a Wonderful Life?
In Gremlins 2, it's Casablanca.
Oh, okay. I thought it was It's a Wonderful Life.
But which incidentally is the movie that like Gremlins, it feels like the one of the ideas I think Dante was really trying to work with was, what if It's a Wonderful Life but monsters show up, you know?
Yeah,
I guess it's time for our final review of Gremlins 2, the new batch, and the question that lies is, would you screen it, stream it, or skip it? I guess we'll start with Leonard, the unbiased review.
Well, now that I've learned from Alonzo that the made-for-theater gags still exist on the Blu-ray, I say screen it. Screen it with physical media.
Oh,
you're right after his heart there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, what about you, Drea?
I'm also a screen it. This one was a nice surprise. Like I said, the more absurd it got, the more I enjoyed it. And so if you know that that's coming, just be ready for it. Let it wash over you. Screen it with glee. It's so wonderfully stupid. I enjoyed it.
And Alonzo.
Oh, absolutely screen it. I think anytime you have a filmmaker who's given the keys to his own franchise and just decides he's going to drive it into the lake, and if the movie isn't immediately successful, you know that's just going to become a cult sensation. And that's what happened with Gremlins 2, The New Batch. And it's every new viewing yields more because it is so crammed with gags. I love this movie.
Yeah, and you know, same thing here. You know, it's a great movie. You know, Naomi liked it, so I think Naomi is also a screen it. You know, you know, right there on our Mount Rushmore of great movies, like Mulan and Sesame Street. So, that's all around. Claps all around. But we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
I listen to Reading Glasses because Bria and Mallory have great tips.
My suggestion for book festivals is just go for one day.
I listen for the author interviews.
I was a huge Goosebumps fan.
Oh, yes.
R.L. Stine was totally my jam.
I don't even read. I just like their chemistry together.
Literally, if on the back it said, like, this book made me shit my pants, I'd be like, I'm buying this book.
Yeah.
Like, I think the problem with blurbs a lot of times...
I like that we both want to crap ourselves over books.
I'm Bria Grant.
And I'm Mallory O'Mara.
We're Reading Glasses, and we solve all your bookish problems every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Who Shot You? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, and in the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duraldi.
Leonard Maltin.
Drea Clark.
And now it's time to answer a call from the Who Shot line. So, Casey, play that call.
Hey, gang, it's David from Milwaukee. So we all know, you know, how Rocky Horror still is playing in theaters. People perform along with it. I used to be a part of a group that would do the exact same thing with different movies and switched up every 3 months. There'd be a live cast doing, you know, Clue or Jurassic Park or Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I'm just wondering what movies you think would be fun to do along with a live cast and ridiculous yelling and screaming. Thanks.
Interesting question, David.
Yeah,
hi, David from Milwaukee. I think I know him. I think we played Jackbox games together because he invited me on Twitter and I said yes.
All right.
Oh, that's I fun. Think. There might be more than one David in Milwaukee, though. I could be wrong.
Maybe. You know, later you'll be on a pontoon, I'm sure.
Yes. But yeah, no, it's a great question.
You know, the three of us and producer Casey did have the good fortune before everything went to total hell to go to a Rowdy Cats screening. So that was already happening before everything got locked down. And I hope resumes again because that loaned itself perfectly to that immediate sort of ambience.
The movie that came to mind for this, I got so excited about. Thinking of it in this Rocky Horror way of like, okay, if people like coming dressed in character, like what has like visually recognizable but pretty easily attainable costumes, what's got a lot of good quotes, what's got some musical moments, things people, and I'm so excited. I really might have to figure out how to market this and do it myself because Wayne's World was made for this kind of shenanigans. Mm-hmm. Can you not see a whole room full of, you know, the Wayne and the Garth outfits, but then also like the stupid ballroom blitz song, Bohemian Rhapsody has a whole thing in it. Schwing, like there's all these ridiculous things threaded in. I feel like, oh, I should rewatch it. And this is, of course, Penelope Spheeris directed it, whom I adore. But there's so many silly moments in this that there's got to be something good to throw at the screen for Wayne's World.
There'll be the one guy who always shows up dressed as Alice Cooper, you know.
Yes. I hope there's someone who always shows up dressed as... Oh, no. Is it... Yes, Rob Lowe.
Rob Lowe,
like the snarky music executive. Oh, yeah.
I could probably swing a Brian Doyle Murray at this point.
Yes. Nice. Also, tying into our previous film, there's a Bugs Bunny quote because Garth has his whole thing of asking about Did you ever find Bugs Bunny attractive when he puts on a dress and acts like a girl? So I would hope at least one person would come as Bugs Bunny dressed as a girl as well.
There you go.
Anyway,
daughter Jessie, who co-hosts our podcast, Malton on Movies, recently revisited one of her longtime favorites, Clueless, and came to the understanding that there were a lot of gags in that film that she didn't get the first time around. She was too young. She's 34 now. And so she experienced a whole new level of appreciation for that film. I can't imagine she's the only one who might not benefit from a revisit.
That was way harsh, Ty. Are you kidding? I would love a screened reenactment version of Clueless.
And that's a movie with outfits. So for sure, yes. I think that would your midnight crowd would eat that up, no doubt.
You could do the whole the finger motion of whatever, the like making the W with your hands.
Yeah, no, I think that one comes with you've got a driving scene that you can fake on stage. Like there's a lot of things going on in that movie that, you know, the rolling with the homies. Yeah, I agree. Clueless comes pre-culted for you, yes.
Clueless is a great one. Yeah, I'm gonna put that. I'm gonna do a traveling road show that's going into the mix. Good.
The one I thought, because you know, so many of the movies that I think would work for this have been done at some point. I mean, like there was the people who do Rocky Horror here in Los Angeles, the Sins of the Flesh group, was doing Clue for a while and apparently only stopped because they got a cease and desist from Paramount, which is too bad because I went to the first one and I thought it was really great. And then I thought, okay, so what do Clue and Rocky Horror have in common? I thought, okay, Big House Tim Curry. And I thought, well, is somebody going to do Oscar at some point? I mean, that's the only other one I can think of, the Sylvester Stallone comedy. But the one I would want to do is... a movie that, that came out on Blu-ray last year, and I got to do a little bit of, you know, historical background on it, is the 1968 film Boom, starring Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. Kind of an infamous dud. It's one of John Waters' favorite movies. He calls it failed art. But it's got some nutty outfits and some very quotable lines that you want to yell at the screen. And, you know, I think the musical numbers per se, but I think I can imagine some, like, teenage drag queen figuring out how to make... like, you know, Liz Taylor's chandelier-sized headdress, you know, in his parents' garage, and it's going to change the world.
I was only introduced to the movie Boom because someone wore a headdress. Oh, Rihanna.
Oh, yes.
She wore a headdress styled after Boom to the Met Gala. And I was like, wait, there's an Elizabeth Taylor movie that had something that looked like that in it, and I haven't seen it. So,
wait,
yes.
Was it, I can't remember if it was Rihanna or it was Gemma Chan.
Oh, it was Gemma Chan. It was Gemma Chan.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rihanna wore a different... I'm looking at a Pope hat of Rihanna's. Chan wore the beautiful... It was enormous, but it was beautiful.
When Boom was cited at the Met Gala, I was like, oh, you know, sometimes all roads do lead home, you know?
Sorry. What was yours?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's so funny because all the ones that, like, are my knee-jerk picks are ones that probably already have some, you know, Fast and Furious. I know somewhere out there someone's doing, you know, a Fast and Furious, you know, watch along where they're screaming out parts. They're yelling that Vin Diesel monologue. I know, you know, Lebowski Fest, people are doing that at the Lebowski. So if I had to go with, like, other movies I adore that I love kind of watching and quote along with that, maybe not, it would probably be Harlem Nights. I'd like to see a good Harlem Nights, and you have to come dressed in your outfits and come real fancy. Yeah, all of that. So so that's probably my pick that I'd like get loud and rambunctious and, you know, repeating jokes loudly.
Oh, you know what? If we're going to do Eddie Murphy movies where people will have great costumes, I'm going to put in a vote for Boomerang.
Ooh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, there's going to be some strangers out there.
Oh, all good. All good things. Okay, well, I guess
all we can say. Thank you, David. That. This was a good one.
Yeah, that was fun. Lots of fun Who Shot calls, and keep them coming. You know, as a reminder, the number is WSY-803-1664, and thank you to everyone who's called in. Keep calling that number. Keep leaving shot lines for us, please. But now, it is time for our staff picks. It can be any movie at all. Drea, why don't you start?
All right, so my staff pick is a film that is going to be on Netflix as of July 8th. And it is a Sundance film from a couple years ago, from a year and a half ago. Sundance is weird because it's in January, and also what are dates anymore anyway? But it's called The Long Dumb Road. It's directed by Hannah Fadel, whom I love, and has done other films that are not in the same vein at all. The Long Dumb Road is kind of a buddy comedy with Tony Revolori and Jason Mantzoukas. And it's so it has elements of the kind of classic car road comedy, but it's also a very odd couple pairing. But it's thoughtful in ways that these films aren't always. And so, which I just very much appreciate it. So I found it a very fun view, really amusing, with some really nice sort of little moments of introspection pocketed through some nice ridiculousness. The Long Dumb Road.
Leonard, do you have a pick for us, Mr. Leonard Martin?
Oh, it's hard to pick from all my picks. But the one that I enjoy touting because people sincerely thank me if they haven't already seen this movie, and that's Sing Street, the wonderful Irish musical by John Carney, who wrote and directed Once. And did a very sweet American debut film called Begin Again.
Yes.
With Keira Knightley. And Sing Street is, to me, the living definition of a feel-good movie. It's not stupid. It's not talking down to an audience. It's a wish-fulfillment film that makes you actually feel better inside, deep down. Lovely, charming, set in the 80s, so there's a little tinge of rose-colored nostalgia there, and some wonderful original song. It's been adapted for Broadway.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if it was running when the pandemic began, but I read some very good reviews, and I can certainly relate to anybody discovering this material for the first time.
Drive It Like You Stole It is like,
should have gotten an Oscar nomination.
Such a great song. I love that movie so much. It's similar. You guys, I don't know if you knew this, but there's a movie called American Psycho that also had a musical developed from
keep,
it.
You can keep that one.
Sing Street's great.
Yeah. I love that movie.
All right, Alonzo, what do you have for us?
Well, okay, so, you know, yes, I'm always banging the drum for physical media. I do, check out my column at thespool.net about it. But I have to say, what's cool about streaming is there are oftentimes films that for whatever legal rights, who knows what reason, don't get a DVD release or you know, they get out of print or whatever, and they're really hard to track down. I was recently talking about movies from 1987 because that was a year for me that was sort of pivotal in my cinephilia, and a film that I really love from then that has never been released on DVD in this country that I know of, I just found it on Canopy, and I'm so excited. And that is Paul Newman's 1987 adaptation of Tennessee Williams's The Glass Menagerie, which stars Joanne Woodward in one of her, I think, all-time best performances as Amanda Wingfield. It also stars John Malkovich, Karen Allen, James Naughton. I believe that Newman had directed this cast on stage at Williamstown. And so the film is very, you know, it's just the four of them. It operates in that world somewhere between not really a stage play. You know, it kind of very much is set in the imagination of the narrator, which is what the play is. And, you know, you probably read The Glass Menagerie in high school and you think you don't need another version of it. But trust me, this one is so powerful and so beautifully acted and gorgeously shot. And it just, because it was released by Cineplex Odeon, who no longer exists, it has kind of fallen off the radar and hasn't really been seen easily in this country for decades. This is, again, a 1987 movie. But I'm so thrilled that it's on Canopy. I cannot recommend it highly enough. Check out The Glass Menagerie.
Ooh.
Which I missed the first time around, so I will take your recommendation.
Oh, excellent. Nice. I hope you like it. I want to hear.
Okay. And my pick, if you follow me on Twitter, you already know what happened in this story. But a game came out for all my non-gamers here, which is called Last of Us 2, which is a, post-apocalyptic survival story with, father-daughter stuff. And then, like I've mentioned, it gets me. All parenting stuff now gets me. Arrival got me. And there was a real good scene. I don't want to spoil it for any of the listeners playing it, but there's a real good scene of a flashback that really tore me up. And I was like, okay, I need a break from all the father-daughter stuff. This is rough. I'm going to take the night off. I'm going to watch a movie, take my mind off things, and I decided to watch The Last Train to Busan.
you really took a wild turn there.
Yeah.
Like really Sing Street, a feel-good movie.
Yeah. Let me take my mind off of this, depressing father-daughter stuff and jump and try this. let me switch out this poison for more poison. as much as it made me curl into a little ball at the end of it, it is a amazing movie, and I apparently they're getting ready to do a sequel soon. Yes. So now is a good chance to check it out. Amazing Korean film,
and it's on Netflix.
Yeah, it's on Netflix. That's also why I watched it, because I have the 75-inch 4K HD that I just purchased, and I was blasting that. Also, Gremlins 2 also looked good. You get all the grain that you need to let you know that this was a 90s film.
Oh man, the practical effects or the when they have the flying gremlin and Everybody is so clearly like reacting to nothing, and it looks so much like a 50s monster movie. I just like, oh, more.
I
please.
Love it so much. Oh, yeah. The stop motion too.
Oh yeah, like, and when he turns into the gargoyle, I was like, oh
yes.
I love it. Oh, now it's time for 5-star reviews. If you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, we'll read it on air, like this one from Sibia Marie. I like when Alonzo gets mad at Iffy. Haha, I kid. This podcast is so good. It deserves all the awards. It's a bright spot in my week. Their recent series on the Fast and Furious alone is worth a listen. This is important, and I do care.
Oh, aww, thank you.
Aww, very sweet.
Yay.
Leonard, thank you so much for joining us. Yay. Anything you'd like to plug?
Yay, thank you, Leonard.
My pleasure to be in your midst.
Do all the plugs, Leonard.
LeonardMalton.com is where I post reviews, book surveys, DVD reviews, and such. And there's a hot link there to our podcast, Malton on Movies, which you can get anywhere you normally get podcasts. And we've been posting some new episodes. We don't enjoy interviewing people we haven't met on Zoom, because part of the fun and the experience of doing the podcast for 4 years is meeting people.
Sure.
And having, having an encounter. But we have done several, and they've turned out pretty well. So Malton on Movies is the name of the podcast. LeonardMalton.com is the name of the website.
And follow Leonard's page on Facebook, because he and Jesse will occasionally favor us with some live moments that are always a lot of fun, and they will take your questions.
Yes, they will.
Alonzo, Andrea, thank you for another great show. Is there anything you'd like to say before we head out?
My sign off for breakfast all day lately has been take care of yourselves and each other. And I think that's sort of where we are right now. If anybody thought for a second that this thing was ending anytime soon, it's not. So, wear a mask, be good, wash your hands.
Oh man, I remember when I was trying to be optimistic. I was like, well, if everyone, follows rules, we should be out by fall. Psych. I forgot the part where everyone would have to follow rules. Again, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY 803-1664. And just a reminder that you can buy a Jumbotron on our show by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Your Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/Who Shot Your Podcast, or send us an email at WhoShotYou@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.